You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Early this morning, Vice President Mike Pence formally declared Joe Biden as our next president.
The announcement of the state of the vote by the President of the Senate shall be deemed a sufficient declaration of the persons elected President and Vice President of the United States, each for the term beginning on the 20th day of January 2021, and shall be entered together with the list of the votes on the journals of the Senate and the House of Representatives.
How do you feel after Trump loyalists stormed the Capitol? How do you feel about members of Congress who objected to certifying Biden's victory, including Representatives Tom Tiffany and Scott Fitzgerald? It's 800-642-1234. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta and a political analyst. Andra, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, help us find some clarity this morning. What is on your mind about what happened?
This confirms, I think, many people's fears about the stability of our democracy. In general, I am confident, that the republic will survive. But we've seen really deep fissures, and it's going to take time to heal them. It's going to take time to really help bring the country back together and to fix the breaches and fix holes that had long been there that we didn't realize were there before. While there were some moments where it looked like some of the fever broke in terms of our national division, those divisions are still there, and there's still people who are happy to kind of, make the cleaves even deeper and wider. So I think we still have a long way to go, and we got a real sobering sort of view of who we are as a country yesterday.
President Trump tweeted through his aide early this morning that there will be a peaceful transfer of power, but the American people are beginning to wonder, what does that look like?
I don't know what that looks like. I think what it looks like, what President Trump was acknowledging in that tweet was that as of noon on January 20th, he is not going to be president of the United States anymore. The big issue is that he still concedes that he won the election, and I think he's still going to disseminate conspiracy theories that suggest that he won, even though he knows that he's lost all legal options to try to pursue a challenge. And yesterday was the culmination of him whipping up a frenzy of people in support of him who didn't realize that yesterday's challenge in Congress was only going to be ceremonial. They were going to register their concerns. They would be officially entered into the record. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we all knew what the vote was going to be. And the vote was going to be that Congress was going to affirm the results of the Electoral College. His supporters didn't realize that. They really did think that they could overturn the results of the election. I think they thought that by going to the Capitol, that would be a show of force that could convince Vice President Pence that he could do something other than declare the vote that was going to happen. He was there pretty much in his role as a presiding officer. And then if people didn't do what they wanted them to do, then we saw them decide that they would kind of, take it over by force. And if anybody thought that, President Trump's words were idle, or that the contestation of facts had no consequence, yesterday was the rude awakening that was never true, and that words matter and that symbolic actions matter.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie, and she is helping us make sense of what unfolded at the Capitol yesterday as Congress has formally tallied the Electoral College votes, giving Joe Biden the victory. You can join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. There's a group of people who can't accept President Trump's loss. Biden, his task must be to put the pieces back together.
The words of a president matter, no matter how good or bad that president is. At their best, the words of a president can inspire. At their worst, they can incite.
How does Biden begin to do that?
I think he's probably going to do what he'd already planned on doing. And I think the big question from this is whether or not we're going to see a shift in public opinion. We don't know yet, but hopefully by the end of the week, there'll be some survey data that will give us a sense. of what's going on. But, you know, the first thing that he wanted to do was to present an alternative model of leadership, you know, one that is inclusive, one that doesn't micromanage and seek to make everything about a cult of personality, one that seems to be data-driven. So not just with respect to the COVID response, but, you know, also just taking the advice of advisors who have a cultivated expertise and listening to them. And then, you know, figuring out where there are places where one can find common ground and trying to see if you could, you know, exploit those relationships, you know, particularly to model better behavior than what we've seen in the previous administration. It's going to be challenging, and there's still going to be resistance based on what we saw yesterday. You know, I can't guarantee that there's going to be success, but there really isn't any other way to address this and to move forward.
Let's bring in Bill now in Delafield. Bill, how are you reacting?
Well, in my personal opinion, the whole objection process yesterday was more of a dog and pony show than anything, because there wasn't really any debate on what the facts were in the instance of Arizona before everything was interrupted. There was no argument that the judicial branch in Arizona had extended the voting registration time past what the legislature had outlined. And to me, there was no chance that there was going to be a reconsideration of the votes at hand. So, like I said, to me, it was more of a dog and pony show than anything. And
yeah, Andra, the certification of the Electoral College votes, normally this is just a very speedy process and not something that draws so much attention.
You know, it's generally a formality. It is not unusual for objections to be raised. There were objections raised in the 2000 election because of the Bush v. Gore decision. You know, there were objections, you know, raised in 2016 because of Russian interference. But this is largely a formality. By the time the Electoral College votes get to the Capitol, it's pretty much a done deal. People register their dissent in order to raise, you know, objections about things like long lines and other things. I think the big challenge and concern, you know, with this particular election was that people were raising concerns about election integrity and voter fraud that weren't held up in court, that didn't have enough of a factual basis to warrant, a legal examination. But yet President Trump and his allies, one, continue to bring those cases to court, and more importantly, they continue to air those grievances in the court of public opinion, even if they're not true.
It seemed that when Congress returned to their chambers and when they returned to the floor, there was a new tone. It seemed like there was more unity on the floor. Clearly, lawmakers had been rattled. Did that mob change any hearts of Republican lawmakers?
It may have changed some hearts. I mean, we do know that there were some members who had planned on changing or who had planned on objecting in subsequent states who, you know, ended up deciding not to. But then there were the people who doubled down and continued to raise their objections and, you know, voted as such. I think the question is whether or not this was the right venue to air grievances, whether or not it's for political points. I mean, the whole debate about voter fraud, thankfully, in the United States isn't a problem. And so when you're like looking for a solution in search of a problem, right, you know, that kind of reeks of political opportunism. Mm. And in this particular environment, not just what happened yesterday, but also in an environment where we can't ignore voter suppression, we have to ask whether or not this is, you know, nothing more than partisan gamesmanship. And in the case of individuals and their career ambitions, whether or not this is political opportunism.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to, you know, this didn't go away. There's still people who are still convinced that Donald Trump really won the election. And they're just not letting the facts speak to them because the facts point in a very, very different direction.
Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie, our guide to the mayhem that unfolded on our nation's capital yesterday and what is normally the ceremonial process of Congress certifying the Electoral College vote count. Is our trouble in democracy 800 Is our democracy in trouble? Excuse me, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Congress affirmed President-elect Joe Biden's victory early this morning after pro-Trump rioters stormed the Capitol yesterday. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Minority Leader Chuck Schumer condemned the mob's assault, and Schumer called out the president in his floor speech.
The president who promoted conspiracy theories that motivated these thugs, the president who exhorted them to come to our nation's capital, egg them on. He hardly ever discourages violence and more often encourages it. This president bears a great deal of the blame. This mob was in good part President Trump's doing.
Matt from Evansville called in to say inciting a riot is a crime and the president needs to be held accountable. Jill from Madison called in to say she's speechless that someone died, and Jill is reflecting on this needless death and is losing faith in community. 800-642-1234 to join in. Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie with thoughts. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It just makes me angry. I do not condone what happened yesterday, but the tone deaf of the media, even particularly on this show, about the lack of trying to understand where people on the right are coming from. We've seen a year of anti-police protests. Many of them were built on lies upon lies, being actively condoned by Democrats and the media. What happened yesterday was universally condemned by every single conservative. So to not try to understand why people on the right don't trust the media, don't trust our politicians, is just being tone deaf. I don't see Joe Biden leading us anywhere because he does not have the courage to stand up to people in the media who just look at things through a left lens.
Steve, thanks. Andra, Steve is saying the media here plays a role.
I am not sure that I agree with him in this particular moment. And if we want to talk about the protests this summer, one, we saw a much greater police presence at those protests than we saw at this one. And this one was, you know, known to have happened. It was planned. The president invited people on social media to attend this rally. And then it wasn't met with a strong police presence at the U.S. Capitol, which is, you know, how people were able to break into the building and roam the place. And I'm just going to share my perspective as an African-American woman.
Please.
If I and, you know, a group of other black people had stormed the Capitol, we would have been shot on sight. Trust my lived experience on this one and trust the empirical data on this. So, I'm not sure that, you know, that the media was being heavy-handed here. I don't think the media was ignoring what happened. This was a mob that sought to try to overturn the results of an election. I don't know how you don't call that for what it is. And I also don't know how you don't hold President Trump accountable for how his dangerous rhetoric has ginned people up. Now, if we want to talk about making sure that we have, that we present, different points of view on policy preferences, that's fine. But, we're not going to do the false equivalence on saying that, maybe Joe Biden didn't win the election. No, he won, right? Donald Trump and his lawyers have had every opportunity to present credible evidence dozens of times in courts across the country, including at the Supreme Court, to say that there were voting irregularities that could overturn the results of the election, and they didn't stand up in court because they don't have the facts on their side. So, just recycling the same stuff that, is being propounded, in certain media outlets or on social media is not actual factual evidence. And all of those lawyers who get on TV and say one thing but then go in court with no evidence because they know better, right, that should be the sign that you are, in fact, being lied to.
We're talking with Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University in Atlanta and a political analyst as we look at what has unfolded at the Capitol with your insights at 800-642-1234. Kristen is joining us from Watertown. Hi, Kristen.
Hi there. My whole point is I work in elections, And I know that the biggest issue here is if you think there's fraud, you should have addressed it before the election, not after the election, because once votes are tallied, once that vote goes, that ballot goes into that machine, you can't pull that ballot back out or say, well, that's my ballot or that's your ballot. If you think that, like, indefinitely confined, if you have 1,000 indefinitely confined that you think are fraudulently made because they weren't indefinitely confined, you're just going to take out 1,000 ballots, not the 1,000 ballots of those indefinitely confined. It's just 1,000 ballots, and it can go either way. So the whole point of voter fraud consists of somebody who puts in two ballots in the machine, who devises a plan to request two ballots and votes two ballots. That's fraud. Just because you say you're indefinitely confined and you're really not, that's bad voter behavior. But it truly doesn't have anything to do with voter fraud. So the instances of voter fraud are so minuscule because you've got good election workers and you've got good clerk's offices across, you know, the country. And I can speak to Wisconsin. But I trust that the people across the whole United States who work in elections are doing it for the right purpose, because if they don't, they shouldn't be in office if they're not trying to help.
Doing it for the public good. And Kristen's saying, Andra, that these election, you know, these issues should have been cleared up before the election, before the ballots were counted.
You know, I think I want to thank her for her service, and I agree with her perspective. One of the things that's interesting is you can do some retrospective analysis to make sure that things were conducted properly. In my own state of Georgia, which is another state where the vote was going to be contested yesterday, aside from the fact that the presidential vote got counted three times, the original vote, the audit to make sure that the machines were actually counting the votes. And what we found, and people were concerned about this at the beginning of last year, whether or not this was going to work, was that the machines were accurate. So the optical scan vote, which is the official vote tally or the initial vote tally, and then what happened with the paper recount sort of, you know, aligned with one another. They found problems of, you know, certain disks not being uploaded properly. And, you know, when those votes were found, they were counted and added to the total. And then there was another recount, you know, that was automatically triggered by the close margin in the election. So, like, that integrity counted. They've even gone after the fact. My Secretary of State, you know, did an audit of one of the larger counties where they looked at the signatures to make sure that the signatures on the absentee ballots matched the voter registration signatures. And they found that the signature match process was 99.9% accurate. So, you know, and this is the evidence that President Trump was disputing on that phone call that you may have heard about over the weekend, where my Republican Secretary of State had to explain to him every story that you've heard, every rumor that you've heard, we've looked at, and we don't find evidence to substantiate the claims that that you're making. And President Trump just didn't want to accept it.
You know, the violence in D.C. overshadowed your state. The Democrats win in Georgia in the Senate runoffs, and I'm thinking about Georgia's first black senator elect now, the Reverend Raphael Warnock, and I'm thinking about he wrote about Dr. Martin Luther King in his tweet yesterday, ending his tweet with these words: "Let each of us try to be a light to see our country out of this dark moment." What do you make about him coming into office?
So, you know, this is certainly a watershed moment in the state, but it's also not a surprising watershed moment. So over the course of the campaign, Reverend Warnock he talked about race, you know, he didn't shy away from it, and he also was forced to because of the racial attacks against him from Senator Kelly Loeffler. But we didn't talk about the historic first nature of his candidacy. And I think that's in part because people in Georgia have now become accustomed to seeing African-Americans run for high-level offices. So, one, it's something that has happened plenty of times before in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not unusual in a state where the black population is 30%. But we also know that blacks are capable and very competitive political candidates. I think Stacey Abrams did a lot to dispel the notion that blacks couldn't be competitive candidates for statewide office. And so by the time Raphael Warnock, you know, makes it to the runoff election, you know, we weren't surprised, and we also knew that he was going to be a very, very competitive candidate for office. You know, we knew the margin was going to be close. We didn't know exactly who was going to win.
And when we're looking at, you know, why he and John Ossoff won, you know, there are a couple of things that we're looking at. We knew in the early vote that blacks actually made up a slightly larger share of the electorate than their registration numbers would have suggested. So high black turnout is one of the reasons why he was able to win. We're looking at strong turnout in the Metro Atlanta counties, which are now Democratic. And then we're looking at lower turnout in some of the Republican areas.
Andra, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University and a political analyst. Coming up, we talk to the attorney for the family of Jacob Blake, who was shot and paralyzed by a Kenosha police officer last summer. That is after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.